Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for Catholic News. My name is Chris Mihalik. Source of our program is EveryCatholic.org. Why the Catholic Church celebrates Jubilee Years, Restoration, Renewal, Mercy, and Freedom, by Jared Stout. Why does the Church celebrate Jubilee Years? The concept comes from the Old Testament, marking the completion of seven cycles of Sabbath years, a time of rest given to the land every 7 years. In the 50th year, not just the land, but all of society would experience liberation and rest, marking a renewal of the freedom God gave his people in bringing them out of the slavery of Egypt. John Bergsma explains the importance of the biblical jubilee in his book, Jesus and the Jubilee, the biblical roots of the year of God's favor. God established this year of Jubilee, a year in which God redeemed, released, returned, and granted rest to his people, as a great year of favor wherein all people enjoyed not just forgiveness, but the other great goods of freedom, family, and fullness. These were the gifts God so desired to pour out on Adam and Eve and every subsequent generation. Every 50 years, the Jubilee was celebrated as the people of Israel basked in the bountiful mercy of God. Every Jubilee wiped out the slate clean to bring God's children back in line with his original design. This awesome, even if rarely practiced, gift from God served as a reminder of God's ultimate plan for the renewal and perfection of creation, free from the oppression and domination of evil. But that doesn't answer the original question of why the Catholic Church has adopted the practice of celebrating an ordinary Jubilee year every 25 years. The story begins with the controversial and tragic Pope Boniface VIII of Unam Sanctam fame, who sought to draw pilgrims to Rome by offering a rarity at the time, a plenary indulgence, the full remission of the temporal punishment due to forgive sin, to forgiven sin, essentially remitting the need for reparation and purgatory. The year 1300 marked an enormously successful beginning to this pilgrim experience of grace and mercy, setting up a tradition that would vary in frequency, but would eventually come every quarter of a century to give each generation of adults a chance to participate. This Jubilee revival reveals something essential about the Church's mission, building upon the prophecy of Isaiah, which he read in Nazareth's synagogue. Jesus proclaimed his own ministry to be the fulfillment of the Jubilee, initiating a new means of receiving its promise of liberation and restoration through his Church. The very nature of the Christian life is to live within this promise of mercy and to share it with others. It's something we need constantly to remember and, if necessary, to rediscover. This is why the celebration of the Jubilee offers a deep spiritual promise for those who embrace its purpose through conversion and renewal. Bergsma explains the opportunity it offers. The joy of the Jubilee is on offer to us. Undoubtedly, we are in need of its power. Most of us have never served a prison sentence or toiled as indentured servants, but we have all experienced slavery to sin, and we're all witnesses to the injustices and divisions that dominate our news feeds and public discourse. The cycles of sin, oppression, infidelity, and ambivalence that the Israelites found themselves entrenched in bear striking resemblance to the societal ills of today. We are in constant need of the Jubilee and all that it brings. The Jubilee year may seem, on the surface, only an excuse for a spiritual vacation to Rome. Pilgrimages, of course, can lead us out of our ordinary routines to experience conversion more deeply, but it's not the travel that, per se, makes the Jubilee. Taking up the entire biblical and ecclesial tradition, the Jubilee calls us to reconciliation with God and neighbor. Leaving home to visit a holy site can mark a new beginning, leaving behind old ways of thinking and living, to return with a resolution to remain in prayer and engage in works of mercy. But more than an enjoyable experience of faith, a Jubilee pilgrimage should capture the radicality of the original, moving us to forgive others, renew our family life and community, and restore what sin has broken. In order to bring in a restoration beyond the pilgrimage experience, the Church now offers the Jubilee's plenary indulgence for engaging in acts of mercy and penance. The decree on this year's indulgence exhorts us perform acts that bear witness to the conversion undertaken. The faithful, following the example and mandate of Christ, are encouraged to carry out works of charity or mercy more frequently, especially in the service of those brothers and sisters who are burdened by various needs. More especially, they should rediscover both the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, which lead us into the heart of the Jubilee by experiencing and sharing God's mercy. In addition, we can experience inner renewal from cultural forces that oppress us by abstaining in a spirit of penance, at least for one day of the week, from futile distractions, real but also virtual distractions, for example, the use of the media and or social networks, from superfluous consumption. This extension reminds us of how much we still need the liberation the Jubilee offers. Rather than taking away from the significance of pilgrimage, these acts can give shape to the experience of the Jubilee year as a whole, guiding us to experience its promise of mercy and freedom, and to share them with others. As moments of renewal, they can bring us back to the centrality of our faith, that Jesus has come to set us free and to bring us into the perfect rest of his communion with the Father. Will you sit with Christ's holy, sorrowful face this Lent? By Elizabeth Zelasco. If you have ever loved someone who was suffering, you will know deep in your soul what it is to make this face. This is not only the face of a man who has known suffering, but the face of a man who is profoundly sorrowful for the suffering of his beloved. His expression reaches from the cross, back in time to Adam and Eve, and forward through time to you in your suffering today. He was wounded for love of you, to save you, to suffer with you and for you. His love burns from the cross not only for you, but for the person in jail, for unspeakable crimes, for those who stomp on his body in the Holy Eucharist, for the person who has abandoned their spouse and children, for the thief, for the murderer. He willingly suffers and dies for each of them, his lost sheep. This exquisite example of Italian iconography is one of the oldest works hanging in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, Italy. I was so excited to be in the Uffizi that I did not think to peruse the gallery map in my hand, telling me what I would see first. I was like a kid in a candy shop, rushing to the first taste. I hustled up the stairs at a socially acceptable pace and followed the herd around the corner into the gallery on the right. I turned that corner expecting to see a Botticelli, Da Vinci, or Michelangelo, anything other than what I saw, but there he was. The words rushed up from inside, "My Lord and my God." Christ crucified, the man of sorrows, was hanging on a cross before me. His face poured out compassion, and love hit me as swiftly as death itself sometimes comes. I drew closer to the icon and stood there, not wanting to leave him. If the stylized look of iconography is not to your taste, I invite you to appreciate it for a moment. One of the many things that makes the Catholic Church so beautiful is that it is truly universal and rich in diversity. The Catholic Church is composed of one Latin and 23 Eastern churches. With so many forms of sacred art in our church, there's literally something for everyone. Icons are easy to pass off as something orthodox, but the truth is, they are very much a part of our Catholic tradition, with almost all the Eastern Catholic churches using them. Sometime between the 13th and 14th centuries, the Byzantine style of iconography made its way into Italy. Up to this point, almost all the sacred art in the peninsula had primarily been frescoes painted on wet plaster walls and ceilings, and mosaics made up of tiny pieces of glass and stone set in mortar. When artists started painting on panels for the first time, they looked to the East for instruction in technique, style, and symbolism. Some iconography proved conducive to storytelling, the main function of sacred art since the outset. Icons do not strive to depict the narratives of the Bible realistically, but rather illustrate the profound significance of these stories. In this icon, the crucifixion scene outside the city walls can now incorporate all the scenes of the Passion of Christ on either side of the cross rather than a landscape. When receiving image as a form of storytelling, we can appreciate its full contextual meaning and step into the story it is telling. Icons can be a visual textbook of the Bible and the saints, but they are also poetic and artistic renderings of what has happened in this world and what is currently happening in the next. To this point, the Bible does not describe Christ's face as he hung on the cross, but we can infer that his love would have been painfully evident to everyone standing there, even through his unrecognizable face. We have all been moved at one time or another by the portrayals of Christ's face in art, yet we lack certainty regarding his actual appearance. By their nature, icons allow us to see directly to the truth of what they represent rather than focusing solely on the artist's representational skills. The lifted veil of the sanctuary opened the window, so to speak, and bring heaven to us. This icon, painted so many years ago, did that for me at the Uffizi. Christ's crucifixion hangs on a gallery wall in Florence, Italy. Some passers-by will see this man on the cross and be converted to the faith. Some, just like when he hung on the cross outside of the walls of Jerusalem, will pass by without seeing the reality of what he did. As Good Friday approaches, we must remember this moment transcending time and space. I invite you to sit with this image this Lent. Will you sit with him and his love for you from the cross? Will you contemplate his sorrowful eyes? Will you kiss his wounds and ask for forgiveness? Will you kiss your own cross as you venerate his and thank him for it? Or will it be just another day? As we approach the end of the great fast, do not let Christ and the Triduum pass you by this year. Missed the perfect start? Lent is about the journey, by Marie Saint Jose. If you're anything like me, Ash Wednesday feels like it was about 40 days ago. But surprisingly, we're only a little ways into Lent. I've been sick for the last couple of weeks, and all of my Lenten aspirations quickly fell by the wayside amid sleepless nights, a lack of exercise, and an upset stomach. How's it going for you? Maybe you started with big plans for prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, but things haven't gone quite the way you expected. Maybe your fasts have fizzled quicker than you hoped. Your prayer time has been inconsistent, or life has simply gotten in the way. If that sounds familiar, you're not alone. And more importantly, it's never too late to begin again. If your Lent hasn't looked the way you envisioned, that doesn't mean you failed. It just means you're human. Lent isn't about perfection. It's about progress. It's a season of conversion, a time to turn our hearts back to God. And maybe the Lord wants to meet me and you right where we are instead of where we think we should be from the fruits of our lengthened sacrifices. So instead of giving up or feeling discouraged, take a deep breath and start fresh today. Pick one small intentional way to refocus your heart. Maybe it's setting aside 5 minutes for prayer, offering up a daily sacrifice, finding a moment to reflect on God's presence in your day. Every step, no matter how small, brings you closer to Christ. Lent is a journey, not a test. No matter where you are on that journey, there's still time to glow, to pray, and to encounter the love and mercy of Jesus. Keep going. He's walking with you. 8 things to know and share about the Annunciation by Jimmy Akin of the National Catholic Register. The angel Gabriel appeared to Mary to announce the birth of Christ. Here are 8 things to know and share about the event and how we celebrate it. We are celebrating the solemnity of the Annunciation. This day celebrates the appearance of the angel Gabriel to the Virgin Mary to announce of the birth of Christ. What's going on and why is this day important? Here are 8 things you need to know. What does the word Annunciation mean? It's derived from the same root as the word announce. Gabriel is announcing the birth of Christ in advance. Annunciation is simply an old-fashioned way of saying announcement. Although we are most familiar with this term being applied to the announcement of Christ's birth, it can be applied to in other ways also. For example, in his book, Jesus of Nazareth 3, The Infancy Narratives, Benedict XVI has sections on both the Annunciation of the birth of John and the Annunciation to Mary, because John the Baptist's birth was also announced in advance. When is the Annunciation normally celebrated and why does it sometimes move? Normally, the Solemnity of Annunciation is celebrated March 25th. This date is used because it is 9 months before Christmas, December 25th, and it's assumed that Jesus spent the normal 9 months in the womb. But in some years, March 25th falls during the Holy Week, and the days of Holy Week have a higher liturgical rank than this solemnity. Weekdays of Holy Week have rank 1-2, while this solemnity has a rank of 1-3. Still, the Annunciation is an important solemnity, and so it doesn't just vanish from the calendar. Instead, as the rubrics of the Roman Missal note, whenever this solemnity occurs during Holy Week, it is transferred to the Monday after the second Sunday of Easter. It is thus celebrated on the first available day after Holy Week and the octave of Easter, which ends on the second Sunday of Easter. How does this story parallel the birth of John the Baptist? As noted above, John the Baptist's birth was announced in advance also. In both stories, there are multiple parallels. The angel Gabriel makes the announcement. He announces to a single individual, Zechariah and John the Baptist's case, and Mary in Jesus' case. He announces the miraculous birth of an individual who has a prominent place in God's plan. He is met with a question in both cases. Zechariah asks how he can know this will happen. Mary asks how it will happen. A miraculous sign is offered as evidence. Zechariah is struck dumb. Mary is told of Elizabeth's miraculous pregnancy, which is in its 6th month. Gabriel departs. How is Mary's reaction different than Zechariah's? At first glance, Mary's reaction to Gabriel could appear like Zechariah's unbelieving reaction, but it is fundamentally different. Like Zechariah, she asks a question, but it is a question of a different sort. Zechariah asks how he could know what the angel says would be true. His attitude was one of skepticism. Mary does not ask for proof. Instead, she asks how the angel's words will be fulfilled. He accepts what he says and wants to understand specifically how it will take place. Her attitude is thus one of faith, seeking understanding, not a lack of faith. What does Mary's reaction say about her perpetual virginity? Mary's question is translated into RSVCE as, "How shall this be, since I have no husband?" This is not a good translation because she does in fact have a husband, Joseph. Luke has always told us that she is betrothed to Joseph, which means that they were legally married. Thus, Joseph would not have had to divorce her, not just break the engagement as one might today. What the text literally says in Greek is, "since I do not know man." This relies on the common biblical euphemism of knowing for sexual relations. Mary's question indicates that she understands the facts of life, and that is surprising since she is illegally married and awaiting the time that she and Joseph would begin to cohabit. If she were planning on an ordinary marriage, then the most natural interpretation of the angel's statement would be that after she and Joseph begin to cohabit, they will together conceive a child who the angel is now telling her about. The fact that she asks the question indicates that this is not her understanding and that it has often been taken as a sign that she was not planning on an ordinary marriage. Early Christian writings from the 2nd century onward, beginning with the Proto-Evangelium of James, indicate that Mary was a consecrated virgin who was entrusted to the care of Joseph. How does Gabriel respond to Mary's question? Gabriel informs her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be called Holy, the Son of God." Here, Gabriel indicates the involvement of all three persons of the Trinity. Through the action of the Holy Spirit, the Father causes the Son to be conceived in human form. There will be no human father, making clear that the fact that the child will be the Son of God. As a further illustration of God's power, he points to the fact that Elizabeth, though old and apparently barren, has miraculously conceived a son and is in her 6th month of pregnancy. For with God, nothing is impossible. Is Elizabeth Mary's cousin? This question sometimes comes up in discussions of Mary's perpetual virginity because it is sometimes thought that the brothers of the Lord were his cousins and that they are described as brothers because Aramaic has a word for cousin. Yet the New American Bible described Elizabeth as Mary's cousin. Who Jesus' brothers were has been understood in different ways. The earliest sources that comment on the question, including the 2nd century Proto-Evangelium of James, said that they were stepbrothers through Joseph. They also, hypothetically, could have been adopted. Adoption was very common in the ancient world since people often died early, so they need not have been cousins. While it's true that Aramaic does not have a word for cousin, Greek does, anepsios, but that is not the word used here. Despite the well-known mistranslation in NAB, Elizabeth is not described as Mary's cousin. The Greek word in this passage, syngenes, indicates a female relative, a kinswoman, not a cousin in particular. Why is Mary fiat Latin? Let it be important. Mary's acceptance of this role is momentous and will entail suffering. It is momentous because she will be the mother of the Son of God himself. It will entail suffering in ways that she cannot foresee, but some she could foresee. In particular, she would be regarded as having been unfaithful to Joseph, and that would involve not only public shame, but, as Matthew records, endangered her relationship with Joseph and her future livelihood and social position, yet she placed herself completely at the service of God's will. Thank you for joining us for Catholic News. My name is Chris Mihalik.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.